Hello, folks, and welcome to Antifada's History is a Weapon 14. Because this is History is a Weapon, of course, you know who my co-host is today. That would be Matt Crispin. What's up, man?
Nothing much. Doing good.
Good, good, good. We're here to tell a tale of two Davids. We're here to tell a tale that might as well be as old as time, because that's about as far back as these authors go. In their, I think it's fair to say, blockbuster hit book of pop social science, pop archaeology, anarchist historical studies. We are, of course, talking about The Dawn of Everything by David Graeber, R.I.P. to a legend, and David Grogow, is that how? Wengrow,
yeah. I when I was streaming it and talking about it on Twitch, I just called them Grab Grow.
It's
like a portmanteau, but it's the two of them.
And it works, Dave, too, because they're both Davids. So we can call it Dave Grab Grow.
Yep.
Rolls right off the tongue. Beautiful.
Absolutely.
Beautiful stuff. You have, as you said, been streaming about this, I think, for months, right? Or you did one chapter or one stream per chapter for a while.
Yeah.
And had a lot of takes on it. I just finished it recently, and I'm very glad that I did, because, you know, maybe in this episode, for the people who have seen your stream before, you can kind of get the summary take of all that you've talked about. I'm going to give some takes on it too, obviously. Maybe we can come together, form some sort of synthetic take. And I think especially important because this, you know, the title of this podcast series, History is a Weapon, the grab grows, Grab Grow tries to weaponize history, right? This is very much a political project that they're doing. And so gives us the opportunity, I think, to think about where their politics comes from, what their politics, obviously post-Occupy anarchism, means today, how we can test that against perhaps historical materialism as we understand it, and just kind of play with the concepts that they use throughout history and what they might possibly mean politically moving forward. Because if anything, what their book does is it offers a very vivid and exciting take on the sort of possibilities, the endless possibilities of social organization that have existed through history. And obviously, as part of their project, we can imagine existing in the future. So, good stuff. What do you want to start us off with an intro to the book? What were your impressions of it?
So, the book is very self-consciously, as you said, a political document. And that's honestly, I think, one of its strengths, is because they know, the authors recognize, that they're creating a very rickety structure here. But what they want to point out is that the received understanding that we might carry around from, you know, a generalist education in anthropology, like that we do get, to the extent that we get any, you know, in education and in popular culture, is just as rickety and just as politically motivated in its structures and its narratives as theirs is. And their pitch is essentially like, this is as convincing, if not more so, than what we're this is definitely more convincing than what we've been offered in the past. And in addition to that, it's politically valent in a way that is revolutionary and has like meaningful implications for the possibility of transcending capitalism.
Right.
And so they're willing they basically ask for that amount of credulity from the reader, and then in exchange they give them this at times very moving re-narrativization of prehistory that emphasizes the possibility for all humans everywhere to think and act politically in concert and make their world not abdicating their control of their lives to machines and markets, but by grasping them with their hands and making their lives themselves. And to do that, they marshal a bunch of evidence that, I mean, I was not really, I never was a ever focused that much on prehistory. I don't know that much more than the general, you know, the generalist stuff. So this is a lot of stuff I'd never encountered about the existence of non-hierarchical, they would call it, social orders that persisted and built monumental, you know, built environments like structures with political economies that we are kind of trained to think are incompatible with any kind of complex social order. Like their main bête noire in this book is the idea that there is a fixed relationship between complexity of social structures and hierarchy.
Right.
Their number one claim is that is not true, and that in fact you're plenty of social structures of significant complexity have existed in prehistory, and they are obviously not able to prove that they were not governed by hierarchical social relations, but they are able to take evidence and put together a compelling narrative in which that's the case.
Right, because what they employ in terms of evidence is often these sort of sketchy archaeological or conjectural pieces of evidence, you know, about human beings live. And what they argue in the beginning of the book is that there's the typical traditional, which I think we're all familiar with, Enlightenment concepts that come down from Rousseau or Hobbes about either some sort of, in the Hobbesian sense, a state of nature where life is nasty, brutish, and short, and you need some sort of Leviathan of the state to take an increasingly complex society and ensure that people are constantly murdering each other, or, of course, the Rousseauian, Jean-Jacques Rousseau conception, which is very much a sort of secularized Christian sort of leaving Garden of Eden sort of concept, where human beings were once essentially noble savages, I guess you could say, that mm-hmm. there was highly egalitarian primitive communism that existed. And it was actually class society itself with the advent of agriculture when human beings, as you said, ran into their chains. And so this particular kind of 300-400-year-old conception of what the grand arc or the telos of human society, human civilization has been the valence with which they would argue contemporary social scientists and grand historians view the past, which is as working its way towards the present nation state, the present political economy that we have today. And those same people, of course, filling in all the gaps that exist with this story that we tell of human progress, right? What they want to do is actually say, well, we can fill the gaps in with something else. There's so much that we don't know about prehistory because it's prehistory. It's not written. We can surmise through genetics. We can surmise through archaeology. We can surmise through what these people ate, what they buried their dead with or whatever. But there are large swaths of that, of course, that we don't know and we will never know. And so what they want to do is overturn this sort of progress, enlightenment, state of nature / Rousseauian conception and try to argue that it wasn't bound to be this way. Like you said, complexity can exist alongside non-hierarchical existence. And also that by only focusing on early state formation, what we would recognize as hierarchical class societies with culture and with the ability to use organized violence in order to spread themselves, with monarchies, with various, you know, forms of advanced politics, by only focusing on that stuff, of course, we miss a much larger and potentially broader story, which is what people did in between that. You know, what forms of life, what forms of culture, what forms of foraging and political economy pre-agriculture may have actually presented to us and maybe do present to us today an alternative path of development that might not have gotten us stuck in the sort of exploitation and domination that we all know oh so well in current liberal capitalism.
Yeah, and the starting point for it, sort of the narrative wedge, is the proposition that Grab Grow make that the Enlightenment's turn towards like self consciousness, political self consciousness in European thought, is not a spontaneous internal process. It's actually prodded into being by the encounter between European civilization and North American native indigenous civilization, which, according to GrabGrow, is the counter thesis to the entire teleology of progress that we've been taught, which is, like, you get the Enlightenment at the end of this process of state formation, hierarchical arrangements, capitalism eventually emerging. You don't get those sort of this sort of self-conscious political capacity for the people,
right.
You know, like the political capacity of the commoner, which is what comes with, you know, these new liberal Enlightenment ideas. According to GrabGrow, these ideas were in fact first really introduced to Europe by people who lived a completely different history, which consciously eschewed the move towards hierarchy and state that defined Eurasian civilization,
right?
And that our adaption of those notions is really our attempt to rationalize the unfreedom that constitutes life under hierarchical social formations.
Yeah, like really, really interesting and important stuff, I think, goes in line with their critique of Rousseauianism, which so much of the left is Rousseauian these days, of course, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's this conception, I think it's a popular conception nowadays, that previous to the Enlightenment or the scientific method or modernity, I suppose, that peoples who lived, say, in North America before 1492, or in Papua New Guinea or in sub-Saharan Africa, were incapable of critically assessing their own position and their own societies and their own relationships that they created and perpetuated, that these primitive peoples, these barbarians, were instead stuck in a kind of quasi childlike state where, perhaps they're, we Westerners would argue that they use the sacred in order to project a mirror of their own society into the cosmos. And then if there's going to be any social change that they make, it has to be kind of transferred up to this realm before it comes down. That because everything for these primitive childlike peoples is all enchanted and tied up with all sorts of non-secular ways of thinking, that they couldn't possibly have been able to sit down and critically examine their social world, their class society. The choice, for example, to take up agriculture or not is not seen as a political choice or one that even someone could not do. It was just sort of accepted that people would rush headlong into their chains and create agriculture in large cities and not even reflect for one moment upon what that might mean for any sort of conceptions that they had of what a good society or a good life would look like. The encounter with the especially with the North American peoples, like you said, gives a counterpoint to this as, very, very eloquent critiques of, say, French or English life and political economy and governance were made by indigenous peoples in North and South America. Where they basically said, who would want to live like this? This is bizarre. You talk about, your civilization, and yet you live deeply unfree compared to us who have the ability to move around, to encounter different modes of life, freedom to say no to rules and authorities. And ultimately, we also have the freedom to come together and sort of democratically create the kind of world that we want to create. So it is, in fact, you people, you enlightened people of Europe, who are the uncivilized one. These, I think, are the very powerful sort of resources that they bring to bear from the 16th, 17th, 18th century that show that there's more to the story than simply, of course, barbarians being civilized by the enlightened West.
Yes, because the evidence that they marshal is of monumental architecture, hugely complicated social formations coming together in prehistorical eras around regimes of hunter-gathering without permanent agriculture and the surpluses that permanent agriculture brings, and doing the sort of things that we associate only with hierarchy, only with like primitive state formations, and only with some sort of coercive social relationship at its base. And they claim that we have proof here that that's not, that was not always the case, and that you could have these structures function in a way that we can imagine by looking at the evidence and you know, conjecturing a little bit, is consensual, is a socially produced objective and not something imposed by a caste or something.
Right. Yeah. The whole it's a real shot across the bow, the book, of two groups. The first is the gee whiz whiz bang mode of popular social science of the people like the Malcolm Gladwells of the world and the Steven Pinkers of the world. And I think they do a really good job of directly critiquing this sort of, common sense sort of historiography that these people offer of a world getting progressively better, as this being ultimately, in a Panglossian way, the best of all possible worlds, the better angels of our nature have won. They do a really good job of critiquing them. But who they're also critiquing, of course, are the structuralists, are the materialists. And they're basically within what you and I would understand as this sort of narrative of various different class structures based on different means of social reproduction, different states of complexity based on different amounts of surplus, different classes arising, of course, from who it is that is the direct producer of that surplus and who it is that expropriates that surplus, and thereon takes all sorts of roles, whether religious or secular, military or otherwise. They want to break that down, and they want, I think, what's essentially a much more voluntarist and idealist type of history, right? Which I think is powerful in its own way, as much as it's limited, right? Because there's been some good critiques of this from, what's his name, Walter Schleidel? Is that?
Yeah.
Walter Schleidel, who wrote another book that you like, which is Escape from Rome, which I read.
Escape from Rome. He's a great non-Marxist, but materialist historian, and his critique of it boils down to this story entirely. First, he gets cranky at one point because, and this is the thing I can't really speak to because I'm not an expert in the field, that a lot of the stuff that they present is groundbreaking and is a new way of thinking about stuff, is been received wisdom in these fields for a long time, and they're really punching at the straw man of like this. Shadow of you know, mid-century conventional wisdom that, yeah, maybe people might carry around with them, but not because, like, you know, the actual people doing anthropology and archaeology right now are perpetuating. But beyond that, his main critique is that this is entirely excises all material explanations and mechanisms of everything. This is a story of human history where humans make history on their own terms at every point, that they, whatever material relationship they have with the world around them, they are able to dictate to their preference what that relationship will be, rather than having their course of action dictated instead by the material constraints they find themselves within.
Right. And also, of course, too, that... you know, it's not, there's a hard teleology, right, where liberal democracy in, like, I guess a Hegelian sense, a Fukuyamaian sense, is the end point of history, where, you know, things have unfolded to the point where this is the truest expression of human freedom, and I suppose also human bondage, right, that this is the end state. You know, there's this conception, but the... I don't know, the contingent fact, the contingent aspects of this are really interesting. I think whenever you bring, because you can look at it in terms of like idealism versus materialism, but you can also think of it in terms of structure versus contingency, right?
Right.
And I think that they're able to resurrect a lot of really interesting agency out of history, which I think is really powerful. Whether it stands on its own in terms of the evidence, going back to what you were talking about in the beginning, where like they've chosen politically, they've chosen a narrative that cuts against that. And they're maybe trying to pull, tease out from history more than history is able to actually provide.
Yeah. But, like what they explicitly say when they will get near to material conditions, they will gesture towards them, and then they will stop the text and be like, yeah, if we take this too far down this road, then human agency gets lost. We can no longer see where humans had any power over their conditions. And since we're trying to get people to be politically active in the here and now, we want them to think the opposite. That we want to emphasize, hey, look at history, what people have been able to do when they've cooperated.
Yeah.
We can do that now. And I think that is a useful thing to want to do. The problem with it, though, is that to do it, they have to fatally undermine our ability to actually grasp the conditions that we're going to be working through.
Yeah.
If we're going to do political action, activism, and we're going to be political agents.
Some because might say UN... go ahead.
If you say, here's what people have done, without telling the half of the story that is the imposed constraints of the material conditions, then applying that idea of autonomy to the present moment is going to leave you batting your head against a bunch of walls that, according to GrabGrow, shouldn't be there.
Right.
Because what's fundamentally not grasped by them here is that they might have made an argument in this book that there was a time that there's not some straight line of development along, you know, a state route determined by agriculture. I will give them that they prove that to me as much as I could have any belief, because, you know, like I said, I'm not an expert, but like as something to carry on in my head as just like a pocket bit, the way we do with so many things that we don't really know that much about, but which like make intuitive sense to us, so we feel confident just believing them. I'll believe them when they say that. I'll believe them that they say that there was not a straight line, but there was a cycle. There was a sort of a churning social world where different polities would bounce off of one another, and then in that encounter, shape and shift. And of course, the thing that's making these shifts and shifts is all cycles of nature and cycles of you know, material conditions.
Yeah,
something imposed, but that people were able to go with the flow, literally, until, you know, those carcinogenic carbuncles start sprouting around agricultural or urban places in the Eurasian, and they really pointed out it is really in Eurasia where this really dominates.
Right.
But at that point, they want to say, pretend basically that people under those regimes are the same, like the same beings as the ones living in the more free world. And what that ignores is that what allowed for that free flow in the humans that he's talking about, that they're talking about, this inspiring moment of improvisation and political rigor and and like the preservation of values of equality and autonomy collectively, it's all premised on a personal relationship between the individual human beings and their natural environment that is literally alienated over time from people who live under conditions of hierarchy within class society.
Right.
And that process eventually unleashed overwhelms every other alternative way of life.
Right.
And turns those people into people who are now as alienated as those other people and are as incapable of falling back on the sustenance of nature to make up for you know, their vulnerability in interacting in a group setting. Like, that's the final check that allows these societies to evolve the way they do, is that at the end, and he talks about it, one of the three rights that defines freedom, real freedom for humans, is the freedom to go somewhere else.
Right.
And for the ability to go somewhere else, there has to be something else there. And the thing
there
about
has to be an outside.
Class society is that it destroys the outside.
Yeah.
It destroys that. There's nowhere to go.
Right.
You are still just going to be an isolated person who is not capable of self-sustenance in the world around you, in the natural environment. And every other person you're going to encounter is like you. and is under the same regimes of control that you are.
We've been enclosed upon for 500 years.
Enclosed upon.
And
so if you try to do
a progressive enclosure too.
And so if you have to try to do politics, you are stuck having to do them within these structures, because that's the only way you're going to be able to relate to your fellow people. And that means that you have to give up the dream of total consensus and totally preserved autonomous desire, because it's not your, guess what? What you want isn't really what you want. And you can imagine in a world where you have this tie to nature, that what you want somehow transcends, you know, a programmed and prescribed social reproductive agenda. But once you're inside, that's all there is. And so, like, giving that sort of autonomy and individuality primacy now means that all you can do is be a consumerist liberal, even if you're being a radical.
The best that you can do, and now we're maybe into the real import of this. And I do want to go back a little bit to the maybe before I critique Occupy, which is where, yeah, of course, Graeber himself was a leader of, even though it wasn't supposed to have leaders. And this book being very much a reflection, I think, of a particular political moment 10 years ago now. I do want to step back, because I think we should continue the thread, or at least talk more about what it was that was powerful about this. I think the great example that they give, which is about complex societies and agriculture, of course, is that for 5,000 years of human beings practicing something that looks like agriculture, they did not create monarchies. They did not necessarily in every case throw up ruling classes, military case, heroic societies. In fact, there were relatively, as they argue, egalitarian cities in Mesopotamia, like Uruk, which were trading with upland peoples who were outside of the urban sphere in which a sort of agricultural surplus was being created. And relatively, as they pull out from the evidence, relatively egalitarian city-states existed, some of which would had monarchs but seemed to have a very hands-off sort of approach to governance, which was mostly done by things like city councils and assemblies, relatively democratic sort of wards, as we would imagine them nowadays. It was, in fact, not agriculture itself and the surplus that brings us a sort of modern nation state as we would understand it, with a charismatic, competitive leadership based on bureaucracy and administration. It wasn't that. Instead was what they, I guess the term that anthropologists use is schizogenesis. Right?
Yes.
It was instead people outside. And they argue, this is another convincing and fascinating point too, that so much of the societies that people have created have been in opposition to others, which they, yep, saw as their potential competitors, or saw simply as people that they would define themselves against. So
right,
it is actually upland peoples, people who didn't live off of this agricultural surplus, looking down upon these downland people living in these relatively egalitarian cities, who created an alternate form of culture, which was based on heroism, which was based on warfare, which was based on ultimately the sort of seeds and the nucleus of monarchy, such as
it was patriarchal in a way that the urban population wasn't. And for Grabgro, it's kind of funny though. Like, to them, this thing they've sketched out is their attempt to get agriculture off the hook, right, for the creation of hierarchies and structures of power. But I look at this process that they lay out, and in my mind, you still, at the end of the day, blame the fucking agriculture. Because how does this heroic society emerge? It emerges in, among outcasts from, and people alienated by, this organic structure, which is going to happen.
Yeah.
Everything is going to have malcontents who can't be assimilated into a social. It's just, it's impossible not to have. It's a question of what happens to them.
It just so happens
how are they processed?
These malcontents,
if they are rejected, and then allowed to create more effective regimes of military power by using hierarchy, by using hunter-worshipping cultural structures. They're going to take your shit.
They're going to take your
shit. They're
going
to win.
They're going to
win. And then, boom, thanks for giving us this structure to extract surplus and create, you know, god hierarchies that we're coincidentally at the top of.
Yeah, and then 5,000 years ago, there we're going to synthesize the sort of competitive, heroic society with the bureaucratic, administrative society.
Exactly.
And then we're going to have the doomed, demonic modern state that we have as kind of like the push and pull of these two things. It's fascinating.
Because it can't, if it cannot, I'm sorry to quote Mussolini, but a revolution is not worth nothing if it cannot defend itself. And the thing about all of these societies that Grabgro talked about is that they all either collapsed internally or they got rolled over by the nearest actual state structure.
Right. And of course...
Their record is... It's 0 in a billion. They've never won. And to me, that is a teleology. I'm sorry.
It is a teleology. Scheidel argues that that's a teleology because you're talking about competitive. You're not just talking about these things in isolation. You're not just talking about the most beautiful society that was created in, say, central Mexico, where it seems
With the public housing and everything. And then, and like the fucking ball-tripping art. So it's like, it seemed like it was literally like Woodstock 94, the chill one.
It was like the most based fucking hippie society of all time, such that people admired them for like 1,000 years after they declined and fell apart. But taking, again, it's a political choice. It's not just an editorial choice, but it's a political choice. And I think one that's very interesting and fertile to try to take these examples of, say, like, public housing over 2,000 years ago in Mesoamerica, or take the idea of women's equality, which existed for, it seems, in some way, shape, or form, for large swaths of human history, and trying to make that normative, right? Trying to make that normative as opposed to patriarchal class society. It's very interesting editorially, it's very interesting politically, but if in every instance, as you said, this is outcompeted by the barbarians at the gate, then ultimately, yes, you are talking about a teleology. You're not talking about a teleology that is born, and this is an important distinction, born out of some form of human nature or some sort of dialectic of barbarism versus civilization.
No, it's not nothing wrong with us. It's not original sin.
No, it's not original sin, and it's not even like some sort of Leviathan situation. What it is are adaptive social strategies in order to basically reproduce human beings and also reproduce your society, some of which are able to garner more organized violence and more charisma than other ones are, and ones outside of that which are willing to ride in on horseback and take the whole fucking thing over, which is a dialectic of history that lasts for 5,000 years.
And all of these societies are, like Greg will imagine, they say hierarchy, icky, gross. Everyone in it feels alienated all the time, and they feel the weight of this burden, and that's why they can't really convincingly talk about the emergence of these things, because they can't conceive why anyone would choose these structures. They have to do it as just people getting tricked over time,
right?
And it's like, no, like, there are benefits to be had, and like if you feel, not in some absolute state, but if you feel that you are in a relative state of progress socially, personally, within, you're given an opportunity to progress towards something in a social organism, you give it legitimacy.
Right.
And you operate on its behalf. When the sun god tells you to do something, you do it because you think it is in your interest too.
Right. In each type of class society, it's not simply pure domination of a ruling class. It's always an integration of those classes into a political structure, into a spiritual structure, into
and
a way of being.
And the thing is, it's a gradient of violence. And the people who suffer the most alienating violence at the hands of the state are the farthest from its political heart.
Mm.
So that means that they are the least able to impact decision making, which is why the state structure could sacrifice them on behalf of a goal that an egalitarian society, you couldn't do that. You couldn't get people to sacrifice past a certain limit for a goal, because the whole point was to avoid that kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
Because that was everyone being equalized socially was part of the deal. But what that meant is, when you have a competition between a state that is willing to sacrifice the interests of some for a greater good, defined by those who feel advantaged, who might be exploited a little bit, but not as much as those guys, mm-hmm. and to imagine that their life will be better if their chief succeeds or whatever, they're going to be able to militarily perform more effectively, efficiently, and ruthlessly than a bunch of people who are going to have to get together to decide who goes out with a fucking knife and gets their fucking head split in half.
Right. And the great example from this book, of course, is the, if I'm pronouncing it right, Tlaxcala people, mm-hmm. who ended up, who were, I think, from the Yucatan, who ended up allying with the yeah. Spanish conquistadors in order to overthrow what they saw as a tyranny, what we recognize as like a humongous and complex civilization of the Aztecs. There was a democratic decision that they made, a fraught one, as it turns out, that we have from the records, about whether to ally themselves with these mysterious, promising Westerners from Europe versus, or I guess you could call them the enemy they didn't know versus the enemy right. that they did know. And so one of the tragedies is that democratic decision that the elders made in this kind of quadripartite governmental, relatively democratic, what was described by Spaniards as a Republican sort of yes, mode of governance ends up being, of yeah. course, a nightmare for them.
But, well, this is why that's whole section is doubly funny. First of all, you have the fact that this society that he's describing, they have these democratic structures. They have forums. They have debate. They have consensus decision making. But it's the same. It's based on the same class structure as ancient Greek civilization. It's no more democratic than the yucky Eurasian exploitation states.
Right.
It's
with
still
the elites.
It's the people in that room are the Eloi. The people in that plaza are the nobles who have vassals whose right. surplus they expropriate. So it's a class society. But for them, well, what if the members of those class consent to it? Well, everyone does. Everyone's working class consents to some degree with the structures they find themselves under.
Every time you're not burning down a police station, you're consenting to your class structure today.
And that's the thing. This is the necessity of a materialism, and what they're losing in their greater pitch here is that the reality of this means the only way to filter out everything but class interest, which is the only thing that can counterpose the class power of capitalism, is by organizing people along a common self-interest in the institutions that they engage, that they are bound with, specifically their wage relationship. And so that means that they have to do things like, you know, organize. They have to have structures that can execute a policy. And that has to have an executive function. And an executive function has to fundamentally operate on, at best, an advisory democratic structure. It cannot be consensus-based.
Right.
The consensus-based structures are the ones that got flattened in the first place. The only hope for humanity is if we collectively take control of the alienated structures. Not act like they don't exist, because if we do that, they will just chop us up and spit us up. And then, as I said, on top of that, he's finally got an example of an egalitarian social structure making a decision collectively, and it's to ally with Cortez and lead to the genocide of the fucking Mesoamerican continent.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
You're not really doing a lot for anarchism's reputation as fucking feds.
One thing that's interesting to me is another thread that they pull, which I think is a very valuable one, before we get to full critique, because we're going to get to full critique, is away from a sort of building telos of more and more complex and stratified societies towards essentially the Westphalian system, and then from there into the modern state. They take seriously the sort of ebbs and flows of state, quasi-state-based political power, which is to say they look at, say, the Nile River Delta, and they look at the way, the very interesting and complex ways that it's actually, and this is a weird, I'm not sure I got this argument that much, but there was like, it was the development of a care economy around the dead pharaohs that kind of created a monarchy. Yes. But they point, I think, importantly to the fact that the so-called intermediate periods in between the great dynasties, in between the great pyramid building and Sphinx building, there's a lot of evidence of the kind of reimposition of egalitarian norms back upon these societies, with a retention of the sort of complex irrigation structures and the retention of a fair degree of surplus, with the retention of say religious bureaucracy or whatever.
Yes, and I think this is one of their most trenchant points, is when they point that is their analysis, their recognition that there is an inbuilt inbuilt and unavoidable civilizational bias amongst historians, archaeologists, anthropologists, towards periods of state formation and hierarchy. Yes. Because they produce the most beautiful objects.
Right.
You know, because
they produce the most archaeological resources.
They leave the most stuff to observe.
Right.
And so we are going to intrinsically connect then those periods to like all the stuff that we associate positively with a civilization, and its absence makes us assume the absence of all those other positive elements of a civilization. And Grabgrove suggests, well, maybe all the good stuff is actually there, and in fact better, and people's lives are like less exploited, and their day-to-day experiences is less violent and miserable, but as a result of that, they don't spend as much time making crap.
Right. At least not crap that 5,000 years later we can actually examine, right, and look at and judge.
Yeah. But again, the thing that you have to end that story with is that cycle eventually ends, because it cannot that way of things cannot perpetuate itself. Eventually, a schismogenetic nemesis emerges to take all that work and dominate it.
It can only ever hypothetically perpetuate itself. It can only ever consciously perpetuate itself, because what you would need to do, and maybe this is the anarchist gambit at the center of it, is you would need to take as a model these, we'll call them intermediate periods, periods of what could be seen as civilizational decline, could instead be seen as, of course, like civilizational effervescence in terms of democracy and non-exploitation and equality of the sexes. Your political project would then have to be to make the motor of history stop, to ensure that the monarchs, that the heroic society, to make sure that the barbarians, the steppe nomads, don't ever return. But that is not an automatic process. That would have to be a global, a truly global and truly conscious process on the part of, if in their mind, would it be the working class or would it just be the people? I'm not sure. Somebody would have to come together en masse and decide that and make sure it didn't happen again.
That's the thing. And that's what that's what technology is for. Like, that's what the concentration of capital does, is it creates these systems of symbol and material, you know, structure that can execute a will that doesn't have to, you know, be direct engagement with the environment. It can mediate it for you, and it can amplify human labor. And if you don't have that, you can only ever have subsistence, and you can only they were able to pile up surplus, but they can't keep it. Like, they can create like monumental architecture, but Grabgro argue it's probably like basically the remains of like festival trappings. It's like, this is like if
Woodstock 99.
Like, exactly. Like a million years from now, you're like, oh, there was a monumental structure in Coachella Valley. You know, yeah. And it's like, no, most of the time it was a desert, but like every week, two weekends a year, there's this giant stuff, and it like left its mark,
right?
Like, that's the monumental architecture, and that like people moved through and would have seasonal relationships, and then they claim that like that's how they avoided domination. But Scheidel points out they couldn't have regimes of domination if those technologies hadn't been, you know, brought together in those processes.
Right.
But
so maybe that's the nucleus of domination, right?
Right. But what they use to avoid that implication is they point to the North American Indians, and they say they had this emergent state-like formation to pop up in the Mississippi River Valley, tributary ones in like the southeast, but they collapsed because they were defeated by revolution. That's the kind of implicit argument. Mm-hmm. And then everyone who emerged out of that had their fill with all those structures, and they consciously created societies that went against that. And so he says you have domination all over the world, but by the time of the like the early modern period, you still have these intact structures in North America. Therefore, they would potentially have continued eternally. That's the argument.
Yeah.
And of course, it's like, well, maybe if the entire world is the exact environment of northeast United States, like its specific array of resources
with population densities.
Exactly. If you get a steady, but like it's not Star. We don't live in Star Wars. Planets are not one environment, by definition. They can't be. So humans evolve in all kinds of environments.
Right.
And I really don't see what the difference is between the Europeans showing up in North America and the upland tribal nomads streaking down to take over the Mesopotamian Ur cities.
Or the Aztecs coming from the south and slowly dominating.
Right. And another thing that Scheidel points out, though, is that even then you're kind of giving their premise too much credit, because it's in the places where regimes of hierarchy around agriculture emerge, it's usually about 7,000 years between the first introduction of like human cultivation and before you get like the real like enduring state structures that can perpetuate themselves. And the thing is, that's about how long it was in North America between the introduction of maize and earlier cereals and the arrival of the Europeans. So if they hadn't shown up, they very well might have gotten there, too.
If the patterns of history were to remain. The seasonality thing, I mean, I agree with your critiques of it. I agree with Scheidel's critique of it, how basically to make their argument, which is fascinating, what the archaeological evidence shows is that for much of the year, peoples in the Eurasian, and we're talking 7,000-8,000 years ago at this point, were nomadic, transhumanent, I guess you would call it. There was a combination of domesticated and semi-domesticated animals. There was the rudiments, the beginnings of agriculture, which is to say, you know these seeds are good that you can eat them. So maybe you like drop some in like a muddy riverbed, and the water recedes, and then you come back like 3 months later, and it turns out that there's grain here. Well, let's experiment and let's repeat that process, and let's come back to these places, year in and year out, kind of like a semi-agricultural, semi-forage lifestyle with abundance. And then they argue for cultural reasons, I suppose, that then these monumental structures that arise in places like Stonehenge, in the place that I cannot pronounce, that's in Turkey, in the great black soil of Ukraine, in places like the Balkans, these giant monumental structures that rise up were obviously through like massive collective organized labor of people, but done presumably semi non-hierarchical, or that is to say, like done with consensus, done as a way for everybody to come together for one time of the year and have a monumental Woodstock 99.
Like a barn raising.
Like a barn. Yeah, that's a really, really good example. Yeah.
You have what we associate with, guys with a whip, like in a cartoon, getting guys to put bricks up on a wall or something. You would have like, hey, everybody, let's get this thing done, because we all have the same interest in seeing the result of it. That we all want to see the same sport match that we're all going to participate in, or we're all going to want to see the same ritual.
Right.
We're all going to want to get something spiritually, really, out of what's going to come from this. And I think that that's very persuasive description.
Yeah, and it's also a political model for labor.
But it's so persuasive because the condition that presides here is the ability to flee.
To move.
Like, it's very hard to make an argument that there could be a real coercive regime to make people do the kind of sweat labor that, you know, churls and serfs and slaves have to do in other social structures, because people could just leave,
right,
in a way that they could not do in those conditions. So what's getting them to stay there? You kind of have to assume, well, it's because they have worked this out. They got together and everybody agreed, okay, let's do this.
Right.
Because if they didn't want to do it, they wouldn't do it. They just leave.
Right. Fascinating stuff. The seasonality stuff is fascinating to me because I really like how it breaks up the sort of like the capitalist conception of linear time, which is relatively new. It kind of nods towards a cyclicality that existed, yes, with through most of human history with regards to the passage of time, and indeed with like social ritual and things of that sort. Even into like the medieval period, into like the late feudal period in a place like France, you know, you would go, this is before the putting out system in earnest, you would go around the countryside in the wintertime and you would just see nobody. It would just be a bunch of huts and there would be families, extended families in them. And there was 3 months out of the year in which pretty much nothing was done except you darned some socks. Then there was, you know, the weather would change and everybody would go out in a burst of frenetic activity to get the sowing done. Then you'd have big summer harvests, summer festivals, you know, where everybody took a break. And then, of course, you'd have the great reaping. So this sort of cyclicality is something that's only broken with the advent of the watch and, of course, with wage labor, which has to break up human, all the various concrete human labors into abstract pieces of linear kind of quantitative time. The seasonality thing, I think, is very, it's redolent for me, and I think it should be redolent for all communists, because there's something attractive about that when we think about the sort of natural movements and harmonies and cycles of the earth and us as animals and how we are kind of evolved, I suppose, to experience those, and how deeply and utterly alienating and anti-humanistic capitalist linear quantitative time is.
And it's such an oppressive thing. It's like, it's one of the chief brainwashing, you know, like literal brainwashing mechanisms that capitalism has, is to just abolish any ability to conceive of like a cyclical relationship to anything. Like, I know one of the reasons that people are just repellent at the notion of communism is because of its implied disconnection between the amount of work you put in to a thing, a job, and the amount of compensation you get in the form of money. And they cannot conceive of a world where they're going to, because like, I bust my ass and somebody else doesn't work at all and they get the same food that I do. That is horrifying to them because they cannot imagine doing that work because they want to.
Right.
They can only imagine doing it throughout this coercive mechanism. And also that it would be the only thing that they do. That your job has to be this thing for this amount of hours a week, and that never really changes. And like, that is what a career is. As opposed to, you know, maybe a cycle of different jobs over the course,
right,
of a year or throughout, as you move through time, as opposed to just have it go through you like fucking gamma radiation.
Yeah, we don't even have, and part of the reason why there's a sneaky trick that's played behind the backs of the producer, of course, producers being, you know, the working class, the direct producers, is that there is no longer, of course, a guy with a whip at your back. You know, there's no longer, yeah, even like a community that comes together and dictates the work directly to you, or that you do collectively out of some consensus or because it simply needs to be done. It's instead the whip hand of abstractions. It's the whip, yes, hand of the abstract domination of the market, and ultimately the compulsion not just to starve because you don't have means of subsistence and you don't work, to starve alone.
And that is what GrabGrow cannot grasp, because its implications are too devastating to their whole worldview. Because if that is real, if abstract domination is real, then we cannot act from our self-interest and like come to consensus decisions, because we are dominated by that emptiness,
right,
produced by abstract domination, that alienation. So the thing that sifts that out, as I said, is organization. It is submitting yourself. It is saying, I am going to give up some of my freedom. I'm going to give up some of my self-interest. And I'm going to have faith that this institution is going to represent my greater self-interest, the one that I can't even recognize.
Right. Because we're all trapped in these webs of ideology and domination.
Yes. And for Grab Grow, it's like, no, if you think hard enough, you can wish it away.
So let's get to it then. Let's fucking go. Let's bring up Occupy Wall Street, because I think that now we get into like the thorny backside, even away from like the abstractions of idealism versus materialism or structure and agency. It's like, what are they trying to tell us about what social change should look like in their eyes, or I suppose could look like based on the evidence from the past? It is it's a voluntarist political, not even economic, but wholly political overcoming of whatever structures might exist.
Yeah, there's no economic component at all.
Because surplus ultimately doesn't matter, because if you can have, you know, you can have relatively egalitarian systems that a surplus arise, and there's no actual, in their minds, connection between the creation of an agricultural or productive surplus and class society necessarily, then that can be put to the side, and we can all imagine ourselves as volunteering together in order to create a new social world in the ways that people truly did, it sounds like, have the ability to do 5,000
But when they were not abstractly dominated.
Right, yeah. Maybe 500 years ago you had the ability to do, even as like agricultural capitalism is slowly rising up in the northeast of England, right? I mean, what was one of the great drives towards colonization and being a conquistador? It was, of course, getting to the outside. It was finding free real estate, and it was finding the outside of the particular class society that you lived in order to be able to kind of create a new world, one that you dominated by, of course, overthrowing any native kingdom that existed and installing yourself then as a ruler of that. So, like, the conception, it seems like the book is in a lot of ways an attempt to retcon a justification for the sort of voluntarism you saw, and I saw personally, you know, in Zuccotti Park, which was a very exciting time in 2012. It was this sort of first shot of a return to some sort of collective radical politics after the financial crisis of 2007-2008. It was based on a voluntaristic call of people to come to a place and make a new social structure. It was based on consensus. It was based on speaking truth to power, but also at the same time trying to craft something new, trying to overcome the alienation and domination and isolation of class society by calling people together and purposefully creating something new within the shell of the old. Very, very, very attractive concept. But I think now 10 years later, we maybe see some of the limitations of that, and maybe some of the limitations of what the kind of political call that this book would give us.
It is kind of wild that you play the role in Occupy Wall Street that Grabber did. See what happened with it. And then decide, I'm now going to write this book that proves I was actually right.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, sure, the thing that you saw might have failed, but consider 5,000 BC in the fucking Anatolian Highlands.
Right.
Like, I'm not. If you drop me in the Anatolian Highlands, I'm dead in 6 hours.
Yeah.
If I was then, I wouldn't be. I would know how to live. That is a fundamentally different relationship cognitively, physically, to your material world that facilitates a relationship between members of a social structure and their environment that allows for this luxurious inefficiency,
right?
This glorious maximization of pleasure.
And the most you could ever be in that instance, or any other instances, I'd say, in the last 200-300 years or so. And we saw this actually with pirates and pirates' republics, you know, which are these incredible sort of voluntarist attempts to create oftentimes very beautifully anti-hierarchical, anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist ways of living on the interstices of, say, the transatlantic world, that you have the ability in order to create that. You can go out into the woods as millions of people did 50 years ago and create your beautiful commune. You can sit there in Zuccotti Park, but without ever actually confronting production or the social relations of the production, you, like the pirates of the pirate coves in the Caribbean, can only ever be parasitical on that other mode of production.
Yes.
And with only being parasitical, then you're even making it so that there's no way to scale up your particular new mode of living in order to directly confront that the main.
Yeah, you'll eventually come into conflict with it. When resources run out and necessitate.
And it will have its competitive power to destroy you, as it always has.
Because I think the answer to the mystery that these guys can't get their head around, because they get close to it several times, but they always back away saying, like, this is the heart of the mystery that we haven't solved yet. And they kind of imply, in future work, and thanks to the future work of others in our tradition, we'll get to this answer of how we got here. And I think we don't really need that much more writing on this. It's scarcity. It's the imposition, it's the changing of a relationship to nature that has persisted. And you had these glorious homeostatic relationships. They are disrupted. Something changes. The weather changes. You are forced to move. And that trauma reorients the social structure, requires it to shift, to change, to adapt. And how it adapts over time moves towards increasing the efficiency of action within a social structure. And so if you have prolonged and consistent economic imposition of scarcity, which happens first with changing conditions that happen just naturally, and then eventually with the encountering other peoples, other social structures, you're eventually going to get to the point where to survive, the social structure will have to sacrifice those elements of consensual, ritualistic affirmation in order to act. And the problem, they can't accept that because it speaks to humans as reactive. But honestly, this is another dark heart of this stuff, is that if that's not the answer, then it's some people's fault.
Mm.
Like, it's literally a thing, a sin committed by certain individual humans.
Mm.
Like, they kind of point to it as being a alliance between the jocks and the nerds, an alliance between the most athletically and virile, the most athletic and virile and powerful physical specimens, and the indoor kids, the nerds, the shaman, the people who fuck around with hallucinogenic mushrooms and figure out, like, how to narrativize the actions of the strong and the powerful.
Right.
And that they come together to hijack the ritual structures of affirming nature and say, actually, you guys got to do, you know, this extra. And but then, you know, that surplus is then directed to buy off the support of others. You know. But that story to them is a story of, it has to be a story of sin.
Mm.
And what else could it be? It has to be people making bad decisions. It can't be, well, you know, it hadn't rained for three fucking seasons and all the antelope were dead or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
And because if it's that, then there's no villain, but then there's also, there's none of their precious agency.
Yeah, there's something kind of Rousseauian, too, about even the way that they seek a reuniting of the people under a collective will, you know, a popular will.
Yeah.
I mentioned the GM Tomas piece, I think, in one of our episodes that we did, kind of contrasting Marxism versus Rousseauianism, right? And juxtaposing to this kind of quasi-Rousseau sort of grab-grow conception of, like, these particular instantiations of this tripartite human freedom that we've seen throw itself up constantly over history, trying to recapture this goodness that existed, this non-hierarchical one. In a Rousseauian sense, the Marxist conception of these things is that we're in hell. That we are in demon world, that in fact it's not our goodness, it's not our greatness, it's not our egalitarian tendencies ultimately that's going to allow us to overcome hell world, essentially. It is, in fact, our immiseration and our alienation and all the disgusting things that the world does to us that instead, and the power that we have over what, over the horrible things being done to us ultimately, that will allow us to collectively overcome this and kind of take the demon and throw it back into the pit and create a better world out of that. It's not a return to some fabled past. It's not a return to primitive communism. It's moving through the fire.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, they don't want that. At the end of the day, they don't want, because, you know, at the leading tip of it, it's I don't want you to tell me what to do. I don't want to have my voice not heard at, you know, the committee meeting or whatever. Like, that's what it means in its softest, most activist form. But what it really means is, like, I don't want to take orders from somebody to, like, die or live at the end of the day. Like, I do not want to suborn myself to a institution that will try to assert power, that I will feel like I'm losing something of myself in doing so. But what they don't realize is what they would be losing in doing that is the brain bug of, like, capitalist individualism that has kept them and kept all of us restrained.
Right.
That, like, the thing they're afraid of losing is what they need to shed.
Yes,
and what
exactly.
We all need to shed.
Yeah. I mean, what is it that sticks us? So let me put it in these terms, right? All history hitherto may not be completely the history of class struggle up until 300-400 years ago or so. But getting stuck means, as they call it, right, this tragedy of us getting stuck in time and place. What that getting stuck means is that we're caught in the demon algorithm. It means that there is, I think somebody like Postone would argue, for the first time in human history, a kind of social system that exists that isn't even a dialectic between the inside and the outside, isn't steppe nomads versus agricultural peoples in cities, right? It's instead this monstrous, ahuman, sort of outside dominating engine that forces humanity into progress with a system logic, and of course I'm talking about capitalism here, a system logic which necessarily sticks everything, that necessarily must take everything and put it under its own umbrella, must make all human life subservient. This may be this way that we live now within the demon algorithm of the value form, right, is truly being stuck. Maybe they're right, though, to point out maybe 5,000 years ago, there wasn't a system logic to the kind of ways that people live.
The system logic was the earth.
The system logic was nature. Right, exactly.
Yes, nature. Yeah. There was a system logic. It was like, here's what you live in. Just pay attention.
Right. Yeah. Or like the system logic was, I'm with a group of people. We create our own world in all the different ways that we might possibly want to. We move around not because it's a political choice, but because it's how you go from place to place and you forage things in one climate, in one season, and one in the other. And I think that, again, where we need to give them credit is in resurrecting this sort of alternate history of how human beings have consciously organized themselves. So that's powerful, and we shouldn't forget that part of what they've given us in that book. We have to understand that the only way that we can instantiate, again, potentially these freedoms that they talk about, if we choose to, the freedom to move around, the freedom to disobey orders, and the freedom to craft our own social world, build it as we see fit, of course, is through communism. But once more, right? And I would like to see that as like an essential aspect, along with cyclical time, those three things as what communism looks like, those freedoms. But again, in order to get to that point in time, you can't simply build that in the fissures and the cracks like an Occupy Wall Street movement. You have to have something that's consciously attacking it, not from the outside even, but from the inside, an integral part of that system, an integral part of the class relation, which of course is all of us, needs to consciously recognize this system and attack it full frontally. Otherwise, you'll never get to the point.
It has to have the ability, it has to have a organic connection to production.
Yes.
It has to be able to actually produce for its own self, for its own perpetuation, to not, yes, have that parasitic relationship that leaves you fundamentally powerless.
It leaves you a May 68er. It leads to consumerist neoliberalism, of course, or it leads to, I was just in the Berkshire Mountains beautiful part of the world. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Oh, yeah.
But just like nice mountains, really kind of hippy-dippy, waspy, sort of like very, very moneyed and nice. But the remnants there still exist, and I saw them, of the people, and they're in their 70s and 80s right now, that fled to build a new communal existence in the fissures of the old society. Many of them believing that it was through their voluntarist creation of new social forms that they were going to ultimately change society and overthrow it. But you either, again, became implicated in a sort of individualist crafting of yourself as like a greater, better creature in the neoliberal consumerist mode, or you ended up merely escaping society, living on the outside of it in this parasitical way. So it's not even like we have to go back 5,000 years to see where this sort of conception of social change falls apart. We've seen it in the last couple of generations. And it's a whole entire body of politics, I think, that people rightfully our age and younger are rejecting right now.
Yeah, because it's been too long, you know. There's too, I think more than anything, people recognize that, I hope so, that you're gonna have to give up something, and it might at the time feel like a surrender, you know, of something eventual or vital to you, but over time will, you know, be revealed to have always been more of a shackle than anything.
Yeah. And that shackle is very real when you're at work or when you're, say, like being approached by a police officer. But it's also very abstract. And it exists not just in that abstract domination of the market, of course, but also in your own head, in all of our mm-hmm. own heads, right? Which is, yep. again, one more nod I'll make to this piece, which is that it tries to break with the Steven Pinker sort of conventional notion of what progress looks like. And I'll say this to end it out, because we're getting towards the end right now. There is an aspect of this book that I thought about maybe might be a little too prescient. If we're not imagining, as you and I just talked about, a sort of Occupy voluntarist movement that could overthrow the entire thing and create global communism, right? Where might the lessons of this book lie? And unfortunately, we may be, as you and I have talked about, many people have, in the process of creating an intermediate period ourselves.
Yes.
Global capitalist civilization might be going into one of those intermediate periods where things pull back, like, I don't know, the Bronze Age collapse or
yeah.
any other, the collapse of Rome, any number
just
of...
a retraction, yeah, less of a central collapse, which is never really what happens, but a retreat into more like localized, geographically bound regimes of power.
Yeah, and these are called dark ages. And I think, and that is a loaded term in and of itself, and I think maybe grab grow, if we're really doomer and black-pilled about the world, which I know many of you out there are, and I am sometimes too, maybe we see some hope in an intermediate period, if we see the decomplexification of global civilization beginning, even the sort of pulling back that we're seeing right now with deglobalization and the renationalization thing of things and putting up tariffs, even the sort of decentralization that we're seeing in this shift from a sort of strong federal government into much more sort of localized states, dictating the kind of sphere of politics for most people's lives. Maybe then, if we're not going to get global communism out of this, we can learn how to live good in a dark age, or at least have some sort of examples that we can imagine for ourselves in this potential coming dark age for how we might organize ourselves with freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. Because in those conditions, then, yeah, there's a lot more room to maneuver. That's the good part of the overall, you know, the horror. And the thing that gets lost in the conventional narrative that makes it always just a bad thing, always just a catastrophe. Because, yeah, we're just looking through the remnants, and it's those productive things that are produced that we look at. Although I got to say, they're going to look back at this era, and it's going to be hard to imagine that, you know, when, oh, it's 2025, they stopped making Marvel movies. That's how you know things got really bad.
Everything's so digital now, there's really not going to be much material culture.
Yeah,
left.
Exactly.
And people won't even be able to really decode.
Again, that's, I think that's a thing to be hopeful for. That, you know, if the box gets shaken up and the conditions, you know, people are thrown into a new condition and have to emerge out of new material relationships and have to confront anew what it means to be a person in an ecosystem with all of the accumulated technology and knowledge that, you know, is still going to be there in one form or another, accessible in some way or another, even if it's just like through like a literal collective consciousness, that I think could very well be a real phase shift of human consciousness. And it's not what we wanted. That's not the dream, you know, of socialism, which is a triumphant, you know, victory,
final victory,
pushing through systems,
right,
as opposed to, you know, seeing them collapse. But realistically, that's historically how class societies have come apart and
right,
given birth to something new.
Yeah, and maybe at this point in time, despite having completely globalized supply chains, having what appears to be a global civilization, really, at this point, headed by the American cultural hegemon, despite that, if we don't manage to get the final global victory and create no space around which the unfreedom of liberal democracy still reigns, maybe the last lesson we can take is that that they give us in this book is that there's always a push and a pull and always a negotiation. And so maybe the best hope is to create islands of sort of intermediate dark age freedoms with, as you said, technologies that we have now, which can be the wellspring, I think, of collective well-being and collective decision-making that we didn't have 5,000 years ago. Maybe that's mm-hmm. what we can hope for. Maybe we can hope for being fortunate enough to live in a good intermediate period where we kind of rebuild, recraft social relationships. Maybe we don't get all the freedoms that people had to move around and stuff because there's fucking warlords across the Hudson River or on the other side of the Sierra, you know, Grand.
Well, yeah, just like just the Boston Dynamics Amazon robots with fucking Gatling guns on their backs.
Real Black Mirror ass shit. So yeah, I think that's good, man. I think we really got down to the heart of this book and gave some good critiques, but I also think we gave a nod towards why people should check it out and read it.
Absolutely. Certainly if you ever read Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is also like poppy and sort of facile but is like a good generalist way to think materially about, like, you know, deep historical forces, this is sort of the other side of that,
yeah,
a poppy, ideological, idealist take on that same process.
A good rejoiner, if nothing else.
Yeah.
All right, man.
They work good together. Neither one of the, you know, it's all about the facet of the diamond you're looking through.
Yeah, that sounds about right, dude. As always, good recording with you, man.
Absolutely, thank you.
All right, cool. I will see you in a couple months, man. If I don't talk to you until then, you have a great summer, man. And thanks again.